Friday, March 24th, 2006. You're listening to the Infidel Guy Show. Oh, yeah. Another Friday. I forgot to get something to drink before this program tonight. No, I'm just kidding. Maybe later. I'm Reginald Finley. I'm your host. Thanks to all the new people checking us out, probably from StickCam, as well as other places all over the web, people spreading the word about us at myspace.com. Don't forget to check out the homepage, however. That's infidelguy.com. That's where we all are. You can join us in the IRC chat if you wish. Some people are deciding to maybe join us in the StickCam room, and also, and that's really just because they want to see the cam. For some reason, they like looking at ugly guys, I guess. I don't know. We've had a show similar to this one that we're going to have tonight. I decided to go ahead and just do it again. And it's about logical arguments about, against God. And I've had one before, and my knowledge about logic is still pretty limited. But Ted Drange sent me a list of arguments that he had. And basically it was called 10 Atheistic Arguments. In fact, there's a link there at infidelguy.com. You can click there and check it out. It's 1, 2, 3. It's the number 1 there under Arguments Against God Revisited. Just click that link and you can join along with myself and my co-host this evening. We have with us Dan Sawyer, and I'll let him introduce himself. But some pretty cool stuff he's working on, and it's kind of funny. I really didn't even know till today he has quite a bit of knowledge about some of this stuff. I mean, I'm pretty sure I'm flattering him right now, but pretty smart guy. And we're both going to be talking about arguments against the God concept, and we will be looking at those arguments, again, posted at those sites. I have their links there. But feel free to call in with your arguments if you have any. They don't necessarily have to all be in some logical argumentation format or a syllogism. Just simply just call in if you want to, if we have enough time. And let us know what your most powerful arguments are that you have against God. We're looking forward to it. The number is 888-503-0802. And don't forget, you can actually call in. I'm sorry, you can go to the website and your question. I don't believe this. Hold on. I'm being distracted here. Somebody's supposed to be in bed, and I'm being distracted. I don't believe this. My wife is going to flip out when she finds this out. I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. Stand by 1 second. This is what happens when you work from home. Stand by. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize. I'm back. Hey, it happens. That's one of the risks you have to take sometimes. All right, let me pick this right back up here. All right, so like I said, I have my co-host with me, I guess, for the first time here, Dan Sawyer. Welcome to the Infidel Guy Show, Dan.
Hey, Reggie, how you doing?
Doing great. I'm glad to have you on as a co-host.
Thank you.
And I guess before we delve into the arguments against God, maybe tell us a little bit about who you are and your background.
Oh, let's see. I was raised by an evangelical seminary professor, so I literally grew up taking seminary classes from about the time I was 5 or 6 years old, which does tend to having a warping effect on one's personality. Grew up, discovered a deep and abiding interest in the arts and philosophy, go figure, growing up in theology class. And in my early 20s, I was working in the arts in local churches and discovered that the arts and the ministry just don't mesh together like they would if God was the artist who created the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the midst of doing a bunch of other stuff, I started writing a book on Christian ethics for artists and ministers, trying to get the two camps to talk to each other. And in the process, over the course of about 3 or 4 years, reading 300 or 400 books in the midst of shooting movies and trying to build my own business, yes, I'm a workaholic, the whole thing just kind of fell apart for me. And the fun thing about it was at every stage that something fell down, I was excited. It was a new discovery. I was getting closer to God right up until the end when my faith completely fell apart. And I was surprised to look around and find out that it wasn't there anymore.
Okay.
So.
Okay. The quick version.
That's the quick version. I'm an independent filmmaker, a photographer, and a writer by trade. I've published a few articles in Linux Journal. I'm working on a photo book about strong women in world mythology. I'm trying to finish post on my first feature.
Okay.
So that's the real quick version.
All right, excellent. All right, well, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to invite you. Here's the link, by the way. I hope this is the right link here. Yeah, there it is. Posting this right now in the IRC chat room and also posting a link again in the video room here at StickCam. And if you want to follow along, feel free to do so. And I like the way Ted opens up the first part, Dan, with actually looking at the actual definitions of what God is first, because...
Oh, yeah, very important.
Yes. I mean, I never even realized there are so many, although they're all quite related in some way. But now I see why, in many cases, when we're arguing, you know, these issues about of the nature of God, there's always some kind of disconnect. Because we first have to define first what the heck we're talking about.
And there's an unconscious moving of the goalposts because people subscribe to a lexical definition of God because of doctrine that they don't really believe in. They always feel like it kind of somehow misses the mark. So when you refute the lexical definition, they're like, oh, but that's not really it. It can't quite contain it. God's much bigger than that or much smaller than that, depending on what the argument is. And you feel like you're talking in circles.
Right, right. Yeah, and what they'll do is they'll balance between the various definitions of what the gods are before.
Yeah.
Yeah, as the argument is going on. So I guess what I'd like to take this time to do right now is to list Ted Drange's six definitions of God, and I guess it's according to his experiences. Some could argue that he's missed a few, but these are the ones he's basically arguing against, which is why he has spelled this out. All right, but for definition one here, he says, God is the eternal, all-powerful, personal being who created and rules the universe. And then, in parenthesis, he writes, being eternal, God cannot come into or out of existence. Being all-powerful, he can perform any action that is logically possible to perform. Being personal, he has some characteristics in common with humans, such as thinking, feeling emotions, and performing actions. The universe is understood to consist of all the space, time, matter, and energy that has ever existed. Some would argue against that too, but that's one definition. Two is God is the eternal, very powerful. I like he says very powerful instead of omnipotent. Very powerful personal being who rules the universe, loves humanity, and gave humanity its moral conscience. Three, God is the eternal, very powerful personal being who rules the universe, loves humanity, and strongly desires that we that love be reciprocated. We hear that all the time, which I still haven't, doesn't make sense to me. Four.
Oh,
go ahead.
Yeah,
sure.
That one's pretty easy. It's Jeremiah and several of the Old Testament prophets visualize God as kind of a jilted lover.
A jilted lover?
And seriously, that's exactly the metaphor they use. A jilted lover with a whoring wife.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, Jeremiah, I think chapters 10 to 30 are pretty much a long invective to that effect.
Hmm. All right, this jealous God again, once again. Okay, and D4, God is that being which is self-existent, that is, which contains the explanation for its own existence within itself. Five, God is that being which is objectively perfect in every way. The term perfect here is understood as an objective sense, he says, as opposed to a subjective sense relative to individual values. So the term may be used in public reasoning. I guess we hear that. We say this all the time, but no one really takes time to think about what they mean by perfect. It's just something we say.
It does make you wonder what the objective standard is by which God, who is the ultimate objective observer, is judged.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course. So, yeah. I've always thought those arguments were rather interesting, too, when it comes to moral arguments, right? They say, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you only have one answer. You only have to answer to yourself. Well, so does God. But you're not God. Well, the point being, he can make up his mind. I mean, up can be down, right? Can be left. I mean, he can do what he wants to.
Yeah, you either have to have the sovereignty of God or the goodness of God, but you can't have both.
Mm. And the last definition is, God is the deity described in the Bible as interpreted by evangelical Christianity. Interesting. So again, follow along if you want to. For those who might need help with the link there, please, those of you who know the link, please print it in the chat rooms if someone needs help with that. And hold off your phone calls. We got somebody trying to call in already, Dan. I think they're they're eager to jump right in on here. Hey, stand by. Let us go over at least a majority of these arguments if we can. And again,
there must be people I used to go to church with calling in to harass me.
Yeah, and again, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize if we happen to go over, which I don't know if Dan's cell phone can take it. But if
oh,
we,
yeah, I can.
Okay, if we happen to go over, again, I apologize, but with the new Free Thought Media setup now, I have actually constrained myself to an hour. Lately, though, it's been like almost every show has been over an hour, and it's like, what the hell's going on? But
well, that's value added for the gold members.
Oh, exactly. That's true.
As a gold member myself, anyone who's not a gold member, shame on you. Join. It's great. It's cheap, and it's fabulous driving material.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And, of course, it will be, you can listen to it streamed from the front page at infidelguy.com, but I don't want to interfere, by the way. I think we're having, is Silky Shoe having a show tonight? Somebody's having a show after me. Let me double check, because I want to make sure I don't bump somebody off or interfere with someone else's show. Double check in really quick. Oh, yeah, yeah. The Silky, in fact, we better get off at the right time, so maybe we should stop talking, but
sex show.
That's right. I'll give a quick plug for the Silky Shrew show. She's having a sex show about, well, it's called Anal About Anal, so you might want to listen to that. But that's a quick plug for Silky Shrew there.
But no pun intended on the plug.
Okay, where do we leave off? Okay, I guess
we were about to get into the arguments.
Yeah, sure. Feel free to jump in any time and start an argument, chime in. We can both alternate if you want on each argument.
Okay, I'll take the first one then.
Sure.
It's the anti-creation argument. If X creates Y, then X must exist temporally prior to Y, i.e., Reggie, if I created you, I'd have to be around before you were, before I could actually do it.
Right.
Posit B, but nothing could possibly exist temporally prior to time itself, for that would involve existing at a time when there was no time, which is a contradiction.
Mm-hmm.
Point C, thus, it is impossible for time to have been created. Point D, time is an essential component of the universe. Point E, therefore, it is impossible for the universe to have been created. F, if it follows that God is defined by D1 and D6, cannot exist.
Now, do you have any problems with that, Leslie?
Yeah, I got a couple. One is that temporality is something that gets thrown around a lot, and philosophers and theologians mean completely different things by it.
Okay.
Basically, Christianity has always had this kind of quasi-pagan concept that there is a time before time and a time after time. They call it eternity, and it maybe isn't linear. It may be an unbounded now, depending on who you're talking to. But the difference is between extratemporal and atemporal. Atemporal meaning no time at all, and extratemporal meaning outside of time, perhaps having its own nature of time, the same way, say, you and I exist outside of the time encapsulated in a fiction book. We can go to any page. We can watch the events unfold. If we're writing the book, we can tweak them as they go along. But nonetheless, our universe has its own time that is different and separate and completely independent from the time in the book.
Yeah, but of course the analogy fails because we're not, I mean, you know, of course, we're still, the book and myself, we're still in time.
Right, so, yeah. But the book's time and universe is contained within your larger universe, like a Russian egg doll. This is the argument that C.S. Lewis used really well in the Screwtape Letters. He developed it very thoroughly.
An encapsulation of times, he's arguing about?
Yeah, a circle inside a bigger circle, like the old Aristotelian spheres and levels of the heavens, you know.
Hmm.
It works really well on a poetic level. For anyone inclined to poetry, it seems to work, because poetry has a lot of mirror imagery and encapsulations and microcosms and all that good shit. But theologically, it fails on a couple of points. One, it's an essentially pagan view of God, which Socrates and Plato dealt with at great length. But okay. basically they argued that if God is a personage affected in time as we know it,
mm-hmm.
then he's not adequate up to the task of creating and running something as grandiose as the cosmos, which we now know to be a hell of a lot bigger than they knew it to be.
Right.
And the big point is that it doesn't actually answer the question. It simply moves where did time come from.
Exactly.
Back one level.
Right.
So perhaps our universe was created by a being, but where did that being's universe come from? Not where did the being come from, but where did his universe come from? If, I don't know, you ever read Robert Heinlein?
No.
Oh, science fiction author. One of the best atheistic thinkers of the last century.
Hmm.
He had a story called The Unpleasant Profession of Jonathan Hoag, where he took this argument and turned it on its head and had God be a failing art student doing his final exam.
I've heard this before. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And the universe was his final exam. But great story.
And he failed. But no, but it's funny. SGO in the chat room says, who created extra time? So I guess even if we tried to say that...
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, you're right.
That's the problem.
You're right. Wow. Okay, yeah, so we're stuck with... Yeah. So, yeah, okay. Yeah, and as you mentioned, it just it takes it back another level. And how far back do we go with that? We just keep going.
They want to artificially stop there.
But they can't. There's no justification for doing that.
They
right.
can't, and it makes it. And at that point, it makes no more sense to choose that version of the universe over, say, the one Carl Sagan jokingly talked about, where our universe is an electron in a greater universe, and each electron in our universe is a universe of its own,
right?
On down, so there's infinity every way we look.
So, how do you think this argument? Well, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but if it were to be restructured, will we try to? You think is it possible to add something about acknowledging this extra temporality or something? Or
I think, or as a separate subpoint, it's a really good argument. It's just not nuanced well because he's targeting evangelicals, and evangelicals love C.S. Lewis. So that's exactly what they fall right back on.
Okay. Hmm. Yeah, and Drange in his notes says, a similar argument might possibly be constructed with regard to other components of the universe as well, space,
absolutely.
Matter, and energy. It is very hard to comprehend how a being could have created the universe without existing within space and without any involvement with matter or energy. Again, even if there was this extra time, we're still like...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There still has to be an interface point.
Right.
There's no clearly defined interface.
Yeah, I've always argued that, actually, that God is contingent upon time.
Mm-hmm.
And many people hate that, but... I mean, because if he moves to create anything, then surely he can't move without time.
And what is it? Michael Shermer said, this is the biggest question in the universe. Why is there something rather than nothing?
Right.
And Michael Shermer points out that that's an arbitrary formulation of the question. The question might even better be put, why isn't something the default position rather than nothing?
Exactly. Right. I've always argued that as well. Exactly. Hmm. Okay, let's move on if you're ready. We're good there.
You want to take this one?
Yeah, I'll take this one. All right, two, the transcendent personal argument. In order for God to have created the universe, he must have been transcendent. That is, he must have existed outside space and time. B, but to be personal implies, among other things, being within space and time. C, therefore, it is logically impossible for God, as defined by D1 or D6, to exist. Ooh, excuse me. Now, what interests me about this right away is that I immediately thought, well, I guess they could say, well, maybe he was kind of in and out of time, or he brings himself into our personal reality when he wants to, and things of that nature. And immediately what comes to mind is it's just not very coherent. It's not very clear. There seems to be a disconnect.
Right. And I think it's essentially a reformulation of the first one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's depending upon all the same assumptions about temporality and atemporality,
gotcha.
But it's applying it to personality,
which
means that the C.S. Lewis defense fails on another level here, because the God that the universe reveals, if there is a God behind it, is so radically different from the way we are, that the concept of personhood is meaningless as applied to it, even if it has a concept of self.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hmm. Adrenaline.
And,
yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and so you get into this wonderful little area where Christian theologians wind up practicing self-idolatry by projecting their desires and their conceptions of the best of humanity onto a being that, if it's there, it looks nothing like them. So they wind up idolizing themselves.
Yeah, again, like I've always argued, I've said this on who knows how many shows, but yeah, God is everything we are, everything we are not, and everything we wish to be, and yeah. And that's what we did. Now, Drange here in his notes about this argument says, it might be suggested that God has a part that is outside space and time, and another part that is inside space and time, and that it is the latter part, not the former part, which is personal in nature. But the idea of a being which is partly personal and partly transcendent is incomprehensible. Furthermore, definition D1 implies that God is a personal being, existed prior to the universe, and it is incomprehensible how personal being could do so. You're right. You can't. In other words, I see what he's saying. How you can't start off by saying, well, you know, in the beginning, God was a personal being. You can't do that because personality.
Even if true, it's meaningless by any by any definition we could come up with.
Right. Right. And then somehow an atemporal being decides to become personal. It's like, wait a minute. That gets confusing as well. I mean, if
that assumes a human-like thought process behind the action.
Exactly. And then we're dealing with the time issues once again. Because if he's whatever this atemporality means, as well, again, you did give me the distinction between extra, you know, temporality and atemporality. But if I've always been confused about how God is, and I've had many mixed explanations of this. God is somehow not aware of time, but because that's why because an atemporal being would not be aware of a succession and that everything that occurs are just God's thoughts. But even that's confusing because
the classical formulation is that time is like a room, that God can always see what's going on in, and he occasionally walks into it and out of it as if it's just a room, but we're all trapped in here.
Okay. But once again, we go back to, of course it fails, though, because what happened when he moved to the door to open it to go inside, we're back there once again, so.
Right. God is the cat who walks through walls.
Right. He has another note here I read really quickly. He says, aside from conceptual considerations that have to do with the very concept of being personal, there are empirical considerations relevant to premise B. It might be argued that to be personal requires having thoughts, and that science has very strongly confirmed that having thoughts is dependent on having a physical brain. But, and of course, there's a lot of evidence for that.
That's another problem.
Yeah. He says, for example, since brain damage has always been found to delete or at least disrupt thoughts, it can be extrapolated that there can be no thoughts at all in the total absence of a brain. Although the empirical support for premise B is very strong, that may not be a factor that would impress people who are not scientifically oriented to begin with.
No, it wouldn't impress them at all. And those that are, it tends to blow right by because they counter right away with the with the notion that, well, our brains are not the only kind of construct that can think. They're just the only ones we know about. And if extraterrestrial life exists, that's actually a fairly reasonable objection.
Right. But, of course, they have very finite brains, obviously. So we're we're talking about an infinite brain. We're like, okay, and I always wondered, how did that connect together? I mean, what does that even mean to say?
I've never been able to figure that out myself.
Right, because doesn't it take time to move from like one electrical impulse to the, even if it's a spiritual impulse, whatever they call it? I mean, there seems like there's still going to be some manner of spatial.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to take the Babylon 5 view and have us each as neurons in God's brain, you could make that work. There's just no good reason to believe it.
Right. Huh. Okay, next argument. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, it looks like we're going to go over, but again, if we do, just refresh go to the infidelguy.com, or if you're at the chat room, you should see a little image there of me just not moving. Well, click that, and then I'll start moving.
Okay, we're on, number 3, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is going to go way over. Let's see, the incoherence of omnipotence. if God is defined by D1 or D6 were to exist, then he would be omnipotent, i.e. able to do anything that is logically possible. B, but the idea of such a being is incoherent. C, such a being cannot possibly exist. Discussion of D6 is here included because evangelical Christians maintain that the biblical description of God as almighty is accurate. The issue of whether or not premise B is true is complicated. Some writers claim that the idea of omnipotence is in itself inconsistent. Also, some writers claim that being omnipotent is incompatible with possessing certain other properties. For example, an omnipotent being could not commit suicide, since to do so is logically possible, but an eternal being, by definition, could not. Hence, the idea of deity defined by D1 or D6 is incoherent. Whether or not the given claim is true is here left open. Some comments on the concept of incoherence, blah, 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 a lot of citations.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't find a problem with this one, even putting my old dusty Christian theology cap on.
Oh, really?
The only caveats I could bring are from the point of view of open theism and from process theology.
Right.
But they both concede the point outright.
Mm-hmm.
Open theism holds that God is self-limiting and therefore voluntarily not omnipotent, and that omnipotence is further a relative rather than an absolute notion, i.e. compared to an ant, I'm omnipotent, but I'm obviously limited.
Right.
So they concede the point that way, and process theology holds that God is an evolving being, and evolving being is by definition limited.
Exactly.
Reggie, if you ever want to figure out what the process theologians are on about, there's a book called God, A Biography by Jack Miles, and it treats God in the Old Testament as a literary character, and it's actually quite a fascinating read.
Wow, so God, a what now?
A biography.
Okay.
Yeah, it won the Pulitzer. It's very readable. It also is a good way to get acquainted with a lot of the stuff Bob Price talks about without having your brain bust.
Okay.
It's a good introduction to the documentary hypothesis and the history of the composition of the text and all sorts of stuff like that.
So also, what this thing is saying then basically here, A is really saying essentially that God, if it says he's able to do anything that is logically possible, it's saying that God can't do things that are logically impossible. That's what he's saying, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, omnipotence has never held that, you know, you can make a rock so big you couldn't move it, or you can make a square circle.
Right.
Those are straw man versions of the real argument. The real argument is something like, is I can do anything that is logically possible.
Here's one for you. Can God make himself not exist?
Yeah, that's exactly what Drains brings up to refute it, too.
Oh, really?
An omnipotent, he says right there, an omnipotent being could not commit suicide, since an omnipotent being is by definition eternal, i.e. he's more powerful than death. He therefore cannot die.
Mm.
Therefore, he cannot commit suicide, even though a volitional being could logically do that at any time.
Yeah, I don't know why I'm envisioning, I guess I had a cartoon vision of suicide. I'm imagining him cutting his throat, but okay, yeah, same thing. Okay. Yeah, I've always had difficulty with that. And they always say, well, he can do it, but he just doesn't want to. I hear that a lot, that God can do these logical impossibilities, but he simply chooses not to do them.
Which raises the question of how you know he can do this. Perhaps he's just blowing shit up your ass. He's bullshitting you, and he really can't do this, but he doesn't want to admit that.
Right.
Or more to the point, the priests don't want to admit that.
Right. Yeah, you're right. No matter which way they swing it, right, they're still going to concede that there are limitations regardless, that there are impossibilities, things that he just simply can't do before it'll undo him. I've often said this, and you've probably heard a few shows in which I've said this. I said, if God is omniscient, truly knows everything there is to know, nothing can surprise him in the universe. What is there motivating his existence? Is he contingent upon himself to want to continue to exist? But he already knows everything. There's nothing to look forward to. There's no challenges. As you know, for us humans, I mean, things that motivate us.
It sounds to me, Reggie, like by those criteria, God is a soul damned to hell, and we're his fantasy life.
Yeah. He's a captain taking us down with him, pretty much. One could argue. But yeah, I've often argued that. But if it is logically possible for God to commit suicide or kill himself, then maybe that's what he's done already, and we're all by ourselves.
That's what Nietzsche argued. That God is dead, we killed him, or he killed himself.
Right,
whatever it is,
right.
He's not around anymore.
Exactly. We're all on our own, because it makes sense. I mean, if a God exists, it makes sense, because what is there? It doesn't make sense. All these other things they bring up about he needs us to grovel before him and worship him, and these are all man-like, finite man want these things. Kings.
Yeah, all drawn from particular political structures even.
Exactly.
Yeah, what's really interesting is that you had this whole crop of theologians in the late 19th and early 20th century from Nietzsche, although, we wouldn't think of him as a theologian, he really was, and Kierkegaard and Hillel, people from Catholic and Protestant and evangelical perspectives, all saying God has decided to leave the building.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why, and we don't know when he's coming back, but he's chosen to create a universe that looks completely like he doesn't exist, and we just have to accept that. It's not worth arguing.
Okay, well, we'll move on to number four here. The lack of evidence argument. Many of our favorites on the IG forums. If God is defined by any of the four definitions in question, if he were to exist, then he would have to be deeply involved in the affairs of humanity, and there would be good objective evidence of his existence. I'm pretty sure already my Christian listeners are saying there's plenty. You guys are just blind. But there's no good objective evidence for the existence of a deity thus defined. I choose to use is sufficient. But anyway, he says that, C, therefore, God as defined by D1 and D2, D3, etc., does not exist. I have a very similar argument. Pretty much the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, any Christians who are listening that want to see a Christian make that argument, an Orthodox, non-heretical, conservative evangelical, read Jacques Ellul's Prayer and Modern Man.
Mm.
He proves that God isn't around.
Really?
In there, by the canons of evangelical theology, he doesn't take any shortcuts, and he sincerely believed that God's not around, but we have to act like he is. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer came to the same conclusion, said that God's not around, and if he was, we'd have to act like he wasn't in order to please him.
Right.
My only thing I've got here in support of Drange is in the notes he talks about the classic rebuttal to this being religious experience.
Oh, okay.
I've seen God, I've had a vision, or many people in history have had visions, God therefore manifesting himself through people, and therefore he has contact and involvement with the world every day. The problem with this is, if God intended religious experience to be an authentic indicator of his presence and direction, is it conceivable? It might be conceivable that demons could counterfeit it, but it's not even remotely plausible that chemicals, electrical probes, microbial diseases, and degenerative conditions could induce the same state so that the individual can't tell the difference.
Right.
If God put a God part in our brain so that we could interface with him, is he going to have less security sense than Microsoft? I mean, Microsoft is bad, but they at least try to firewall shit. God doesn't even do that. You eat a morning glory by accident. You've seen God.
Right, and this is a point I've always had difficulty trying to get across to people. It's like, look, if God really wanted human beings to know him, he'd know what sufficient evidence is that he can provide so that we'd stop fighting and arguing about it. And many people just don't get it. They go, there's plenty of evidence. No, you don't understand. I could not deny it. You choose to deny it. Wait a minute. God would know. I mean, I guess they have. Yeah. That's why I see now why, and you've been there. They have to convince themselves that I'm being dishonest in some way, that I'm lying about it.
And that doesn't work at all either.
Really?
There is no way that if God wanted people to know him.
Right. You can deny it.
Well, you could avoid it, or you could not give a shit. But anyone who goes searching for God.
Right.
Like you or me, or say Nietzsche or Michael Shermer or Bart Ehrman, these are people who it mattered to, either because they were curious or because they sincerely loved God and wanted to get closer to him, or both. And a God who creates a universe so that we can all relate to him if we choose to, and then those of us that choose to find out that he's not there.
Right. Oh,
that
wow.
It speaks volumes.
It does.
I think the next item is the argument from non-belief. general non-belief, it doesn't carry much weight with me because, I mean, you know people, Reg. People don't even give a shit about who's the president of the country, let alone who's God of the universe, right?
Right.
Unless the president or God is doing something to piss them off.
Mm-hmm.
But the people that care, that go out of their way, that make it part of their life's goal to honor the God, to be an activist for him, to learn about him, to search and know him, and then find out he's not there, that is compelling evidence that no such thing exists at all.
Right. Or one could argue that, well, God simply wants to send people to hell. If it's a Christian variety, definition six God, that he simply wants to send people to hell, so therefore he doesn't give you. But, of course, that completely destroys the whole idea that God cares about human salvation in any way.
Yeah, not even Calvin's God, who is the ugliest God I have ever heard of, wasn't actually a devil. Not even Calvin's God does that. For Calvin, the call to find God meant that you were saved, even if you never heard the gospel. Not even Calvin's God is that cruel. And the only God that could possibly work that way is the God of the deists, whom, at best, we're kind of a curiosity on the way towards something he's doing elsewhere.
Right.
And he might have sympathy with us like we would have for a rodent caught in a trap, right? But we're not going to break our hearts over it. You know, that kind of God still kind of holds up under arguments of non-belief, but no other kind of God really does.
Right. And to make the point that people understand this, is that doesn't mean that the deistic God is off the hook either as far as other arguments.
Of course not.
Right, that's just that one, just this one particular one. So
we
skipped the argument from evil, by the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that's okay. And I'll I guess because you went to six, so I'll go read this one here. The argument from evil, and it's amazing how many theologians, by the way, keep claiming that this is such a passé argument that it just is irrelevant today. We've addressed all these issues. I don't know why the adherents of whatever other argument are still for it. But anyway, it says if there were to exist a very powerful personal being who rules the universe and loves humanity, then there would not occur as much evil, suffering and premature death, as there does. B, but there does occur that much evil. C, therefore, there does not exist such a being. D, hence God, as defined by D2, D3, or D6, does not exist. Right, I mean, you'd have to be a very malicious God, not one who's loving and cares about humanity. He'd be the complete opposite of that.
Absolutely, and Grange is the only person I've ever read that actually pulled this off properly, because he nuances it, the difference between natural evil and human evil,
exactly,
and actually addresses that argument that, you know, well, free will trumps this. It doesn't. William Lane Craig is full of shit. It's the free will defense isn't adequate to account for natural evil.
No.
But worse than that, I'm jumping around the list here, as I found out later, but worse than that, the universe itself, from a human perspective, is irretrievably evil. We have this habitat that's 4 miles deep, maybe five, that's 25,000 miles long and 19,000 miles wide, places on Earth we can exist without life support. That's out of, just in the solar system, in the sphere that makes up the cloud, you could fit hundreds of trillions of Earths.
Right.
And yet, nowhere is there even life that we've found yet. Maybe there's a microbe here and there on one of the moons of Saturn. Maybe if the universe is lucky, there's life out in the galaxy somewhere. But that is an incredible testament to we are not the point. The entire universe is pitted against us in a kind of radical way. So it's not just that people die in landslides. It's that dinosaurs die as a result of asteroid collisions, and people die from the poisoning of the sun that is supposed to keep us alive. This isn't a system designed to keep us alive. This is a system we figured out how to beat for now.
I haven't figured that one out either with the dinosaurs either, by the way, if there's a God, but...
Yeah, that's but a system that we've figured out how to beat is not a system. It's not a Garden of Eden that a loving God put
right.
in place
mm-hmm.
for us to be uniquely nurtured by.
Right. And of course, we know the D6 definition of people will, of course, assert the fall from grace and all those things, and hence that is why. But that doesn't address though why do animals suffer too, which is also a problem that argument has.
Yeah, and that argument held up kind of well right up until Kepler.
Oh yeah.
And once Kepler figured out how big the universe was, which he did by his planetary laws of motion, that went out the window. Because as long as the world is just us, right?
Right.
It's conceivable. It's a little preposterous, but it's conceivable that our sin could doom creation. But once you get out past us and a few spheres rotating around us, is the sin, even the worst possible sin that you could imagine, mm-hmm. let's say all the worst possible sins that have ever been done by the whole human race, dumped into a bucket and poured on God's head, is that enough to doom 500 trillion galaxies made up of hundreds of billions
wow.
of stars?
Wow.
Hundreds of millions of light years across each of them?
Yeah, it's like,
why
I've often wondered, yeah, why go through all the effort to create all of this, if, like you said, if it's just us? And I guess mm-hmm. some arguments could be that, well, see, God knew that eventually at one point we'd get to the technology where we could traverse the stars, so he made it so vast so that we couldn't reach him. And I went, well, that's silly. I mean, surely he could imply a force that wouldn't allow us to...
Yeah, put up a fence,
right.
I put up a fence to keep neighbors' dogs out of my yard.
Exactly, right.
God is at least as smart as me if such a being exists.
Right, right, exactly. Just or what's it, radiation belt? Is it Kuiper?
Kuiper belt?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Just make it a hell of a lot stronger so that nothing can get past
kidding.
It.
Bound us right in the solar system.
Exactly, right. There's so many things you could do to keep us down here. So, yeah, it just doesn't make any sense to have all that. And, again, I've heard some say, well, the awe of it, that you see that's evidence of God's glory and power. So, well, we wouldn't really know the difference if there was really a firmament, would we? I mean, we'd mm-hmm. find the heavenly crystalline firmament just as glorious and heavy, and wonderful as cloud nebulas. I mean,
yep. Now Yuri Gagarin wasn't just bullshitting or parroting the state line when he got up into orbit and said, "I don't see God up here." Up until that point, it was still a fairly reasonable assumption that you were going to get up there and you were going to see something different.
And people today cannot fathom that. See, as technology changes, as we gain knowledge, we're like, oh, whatever. I mean, we obviously don't believe that now. We do the same thing.
Yeah, we retroject what we know now back onto what they knew then,
right.
Which is where a lot of shitty apologetics came from.
Right. I see the same thing. I always argue this about all the other gods that have gone extinct. We go, well, my God is different. Well, people back then believed these things, and now today you go, mm-hmm. because, thanks to science, by the way, you don't accept or believe these those mythologies, but yours is still riddled with them. And then,
yep, at some point, someone really did believe that if you climbed Mount Olympus, Zeus was going to squish you.
Wow.
And then someone climbed it, and all of a sudden, Homer's gods moved from the mountain
right.
up into the sky.
Exactly. And then we started flying in planes in the sky and kites and telescopes and everything else, and oop, I guess he's not there. Let's move on to space, Then we start looking out into space. Well, we still don't see him. Oh, he's in another dimension. It's like it just does not end. So what's going to happen next? We need to create some kind of machine that can help us hop dimensions and search for God. And then if we start hopping dimensions, if it were even possible, then what? Then he's not there. Well, I guess he's in some kind of hyper dimension. It just never stops.
Yeah, and the problem is that at every single step along this train ride, God could have been there.
Oh, yeah, but...
and he wasn't. And that's much more important than even we'd like to think. God could have been in a crystal sphere above the sky, and the stars could have just been markers for the seasons so people would know how to plant their crops.
Right.
God could have been living on Mars. God could have been the sun. And that just happened to be his radiance pouring down on us. Everywhere we've looked, someone has had a mythology that said, that's God.
Right.
And it, and any one of them could have either been God or could have been a sign saying God was here. And none of them have. It's not even that God doesn't speak our language. It's that the language in which the universe is written, if you'll forgive the poetic conceit, screams, I don't give a shit about you.
Right.
There is, you know, if God is around, he doesn't want us to know about it.
Right, that's another problem too, right, right. So it should be pretty obvious, if that were the case. All right, okay, where are we now? We did argue.
Oh, let's see, we've been jumping
now.
All over the place.
Yeah, I guess we can.
Oh, I think we're kind of like more or less at number seven.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. We kind of hit them all in some kind of way, actually.
Yeah, we really did, because they all wrap up in the same package.
Yeah, you go ahead and take seven.
All right. Arguments from incoherence. And I think this is, I think I told you this before, I think this is kind of his weakest one.
Right.
In order for X to explain Y, not only must X be derivable from Y, but the derivation needs to be in some way illuminating. I don't even know. I understand what it means, but I don't have a good analogy.
Right.
If X is derived from its, the point B, if X is derived from itself, then the derivation is in no way illuminating. C, thus it is impossible for anything to explain itself. D, God is defined by D4, not as defined by D4, is supposed to explain itself. E, it follows that the idea of God, as defined by D4, is incoherent. F, furthermore, perfection is relative, and so the concept of objectively perfect as a concept in public reasoning makes no sense. G, hence, the idea of God, as defined by B5, is also incoherent. H, in addition, the Bible contains descriptions of God that are incoherent, e.g., implying that both Jesus and God, that both Jesus is God and that Jesus is God's Son, that God is a spirit or a spirit, that God is love. I, evangelical Christians interpret those descriptions literally. J, therefore, it must be argued that the idea of God as defined by D6 is also incoherent.
All right, now what the heck all that means in simple terms?
Okay. After point D, or
H.
After point F,
okay,
it's
okay.
Kind of okay, and after H, it's really strong.
Right, right.
But I think that he's wrong on points A through D, and Dr. Drange, if you're listening, I'm really sorry because I love your work, but you're wrong. The reason is this. If there is no God, the universe is self-derived. It's recursive. It has to be. If there's no God, the universe is all that is, and anytime you have all something that is all that is, it is self-derived and self-describing. We see this in mathematics with Mobius strips. We see this in astrophysics with singularities. At some point, the system has to be self-contained. Or you have infinities on every side, and the net effect is that the system is self-derived. So you can't disprove God by a set of criteria that you then use every day to assume that the universe exists. It's logically inconsistent.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Well... somewhat, because it seems like, well, okay, what you're saying yeah, makes sense. I'm trying to figure out how it relates to it. I think that's why you mentioned the first couple of passages that he mentioned, like, it's like extra. Like, why did he even need to be there? Because it seems like, to me, at first, he's really saying...
I think he's trying to disprove definition four with those, which says that God is self-existent and contains the explanation
right.
for itself.
And right, and but God is just, there's no... You can't really use that as an explanation for anything, essentially,
right.
What he's
going
to argue.
Taken on its own, that definition pretty much adds up just to Joseph Campbell's God, which is, God is the name that we give to the mystery that transcends all our categories, i.e., God's what we call the things we don't know about.
I like that, the name that we give to it. And in your notes, something you sent me said, yeah, we put a name to these things, these complex things, but when we start looking at them and analyzing them, we realize that we have nothing really to work with at all.
Yeah, and to be fair, we've got these linguistic placeholders in every discipline. You know, we've got dark matter and astrophysics. Dark matter doesn't mean anything. dark matter means something that's doing this shit we can't explain.
Exactly.
But we know there's got to be something there.
Right.
There's metal fatigue, which basically gives a name to something that happens but doesn't explain it. You know, we've got these things all over the language.
Mm-hmm.
So on that level, using God as a semantic placeholder, which is what people practically do all the time,
mm-hmm.
isn't actually terribly unreasonable, and it's a good way of describing the way humans relate to metaphysical problems.
But then again, of course, it's just that, well, as you know, that's why we just have to start from the definitions, because
yep.
this is where we always end up bumping heads with other believers and whatnot. Because...
Yeah, it's the sleight of hand when believers come in and say, ha, to Einstein, for example, and say, ha, you believe in God, or to Hawking, ha, you believe in God.
Right.
And they're like, no, but you say God here and God there. They're like, no, I'm using God exactly the same way that these other people do,
and
mystics and
exactly.
mythology scholars. I'm using God to mean the thing I don't get, or the whole package,
one
way or the other. It's a semantic placeholder, and religious people, particularly Cornelius Van Til, William Dembski, and William Lane Craig, are really bad about this. They dishonestly establish the precedents for that kind of language as a placeholder, and then they try to slip in a definition to a placeholder, which by definition is definitionless.
So thus
they use atheistic philosophers and scientists to prove their God exists and it's not legitimate.
Interesting. Right. Yeah, so yeah, they're going one step further. Yeah, it's just wrong to go another step further and start ascribing all these characteristics to something of which you have not yet proven. But I guess the problem is, of course, is that they think their holy book has enough information about their deity that they're really going off that. But I think in many cases, though, when they're debating these issues, though, it doesn't come out right away that that's where they're really pulling their information from immediately.
Yeah, and on one level, there's no problem with that. Until you go back and look at the book.
Right.
And I don't know if you've seen that glorious debate that Price has with Greg Boyd that's up on UCTV, but...
No, I have not seen that.
Oh, it's free streaming. I think it's UCTV.org or .com. If you search through, they've got all sorts of debates up there. Price just takes Greg Boyd completely apart by circular reasoning on the Gospels.
Wow.
And, all of this stuff holds up until you go back and look at the book, and the book itself is self-defeating if you read it with any kind of honesty. You cannot get there from here. You can't get contemporary theism or even ancient Judaism out of that book and still be fair to the people who wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you believe that God inspired it, you have to believe that the people it was given to understood at least most of what was going on, and it meant something in their culture. And if you want to understand what it means now, you have to understand what it means then. And once you do that, you come up against this wall where no two authors in the entire Old Testament thought God was the same person.
Exactly.
No two of them thought righteousness meant the same thing.
That's right.
They were all, they were all writing to their neighbors, trying to make sense out of what was going on.
Exactly.
And they wrote some cool shit, and they wrote some really appalling shit, but you cannot find God in there.
Nope. I've always argued that, too. I said, if God is so infinite and so powerful, and he has a glorious plan that nobody knows, then there's no way human beings, even if the Bible is the word of God, there's still no way you can truly know his word. Or his plans, or what he really wants. You're only going to get a small idea of, and damn sure not his nature. You're just going to get a small, they never really get that, though. The Bible says it, whatever.
Yeah, and one of the fun things about theology as a discipline is if you go back and read all the theologians, I haven't read all of them, but there's a radical school of theology that goes alongside people who sincerely believe, people like David Hume, who we think of as a great atheist. He was a theologian. He believed in God firmly and deeply.
Mm-hmm.
These people wanted to make sure, because they believed in God, they had no problem questioning him, because how can you hurt God? And so all of these arguments that we use, And all of these arguments that completely demolish Christianity did not come from outside. Without fail, every single one of them was first and usually best articulated by someone who believed in God, made the argument that he didn't exist, and then had to sidestep and find other grounds that they weren't expert in to hang on to as a way to maintain belief.
You know, it's funny. I once heard that the Catholic Church actually did that. The early Catholic Church actually held these meetings, and I forgot what he called it, but in which they would basically try to train people in arguing or debating God's existence, but they had to first come up with all the arguments against God first, and a lot of our best arguments actually came from a lot of those meetings in the early Catholic Church.
Yeah, there's a great documentary you can get off BitTorrent. I don't remember who hosts it, but it's a BBC documentary called The History of Unbelief. And he goes, and the first episode is going through all the Christian thinkers that made what we do now possible. They made atheism intellectually respectable as a way to strengthen Christianity in the face of rival religions.
Interesting. The History of Unbelief. I think someone sent me that a long time ago. I don't know where it is now. But anyway, okay.
Well worth watching.
Yeah. All right, we have 4 minutes left at the top of the hour. Then, again, ladies and gentlemen, if you get disconnected, if you're listening through Supercast, again, if you want to continue to listen to me, please do so. I'm going to try to wrap this up as quickly as we can, but we have 3 more arguments to go through. And let me see here. If you're a gold member, you can always listen to this at any time. If you're not going to call in and you're a gold member, please tune in to Silky's show, because I know I'm going to miss it. So, and I really wanted to hear it myself. But let's move on. Oh, yes, I was going to say, yeah, just go ahead and tune into the video feed, which through the StickCam feed, which also has audio, so you can go ahead and come there if you want to continue to listen. And we're all going to take some calls here at the top of the hour here. We should be done by then. But cool. I do want to take a few calls. Okay, all right, 8 is the argument from confusion. Without even having to go through all of that, I think we pretty much know what this is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, Ted is arguing here that I guess I should read it in his language here. If the deity described in the Bible as interpreted by evangelical Christianity were to exist, then there would not exist as much confusion and conflictedness among Christians as there does, particularly with regard to important doctrinal issues such as God's laws and the requirements for salvation. But there does exist that much, this is B. Christians disagree widely among themselves on such issues, as shown, among other things, by the great number of different Christian denominations and sects that exist. I believe last count I saw, adherence.com, like Christian,
30,000
different Christian sects. All right, so C, he says, therefore, that deity does not exist. D, hence God is defined by D6, the evangelical God, does not exist. What do you think about that one?
I think he's bulletproof. I tried every which way to find anything weak from a theistic perspective, and I couldn't.
Right.
The problem with all the defenses is that if you take Jesus' words seriously, then all believers are indwelt with the Holy Spirit. They may not listen to him all the time,
right,
but they have contact with him. And the Holy Spirit, it's possible to concede for the sake of argument that he's not compulsory on moral issues. He allows people to screw up.
Okay.
Right. But if people are indwelt by the Holy Spirit, and they would have to know God's plan of salvation, they'd know how they got it, right? They'd know how the Spirit entered them. They would have at least some basic agreement on what morality is, even if they didn't follow it. And time and again, we see in the Christian world, even allowing for 50% of all Christians to be self-deluded, we see time and again in the Christian world such a profound divisiveness between the sects where they can't even agree whether God is one or three in one.
Right.
Because Orthodox Christianity has Unitarians, it has Trinitarians, and it has tritheists in it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't even agree on what God is.
That's right.
You can't agree on what Christ was. There's a heretical position and an official position, but they are both within the bounds of historic normative Christianity. You can't agree on not only on how you get saved, but they can't agree in the pages of the scriptures what salvation consists of. Is it living life abundantly, as Jesus said? Or is it exaltation after death to a celestial realm, like Paul said? Or is it waiting for the parousia so you can see the new heaven and the new earth, like John said? They don't agree, even right. on what their own words mean. There is no way that the Holy Spirit is involved in this in any way.
Wow. You know, and this actually leads to the next argument, actually, nine, the argument from biblical defects.
Mm-hmm.
Right, you just mentioned some of those errors. They're textual errors, and without even needing to read the entire thing, basically, Ted is arguing that, hey, I mean, if the evangelical God is the real God, then the Bible shouldn't have as many problems in it as it does. But it has
Absolutely.
Plenty of problems, so therefore it can't be the deity God that had anything to even do with this book you guys are talking about here. It just has way too many errors. We can't be convinced by it, but the God of D6 God requires that we know his word. But how can we when it's self-contradictory?
Yeah. Now, evangelicals have a really clever reaction to this.
Oh, really?
It's best articulated by Alistair McGrath and by Bruce Metzger. And if anyone's wondering who Bruce Metzger is, he's a textual critic. Every Bible that you read these days is Bruce Metzger's fault. He's the one that assembled
really?
The critical edition of the New Testament.
And by the way, not the guy who not the guy who was with the Marijuana Policy Project, by the way. That's another Bruce Metzger.
No, no, different guy. But what they say, there's the standard inerrantist argument, which is, you know, it was complete in its original autographs.
Oh, here we
which
go.
Which is a clever way of saying we don't know what the hell it says, but we're going to pretend that it's right.
Thank you very much. There's no such thing as an original autograph. What are you talking about? This is
right. Now, this is not the position that people like Metzger and McGrath take. They are not inerrantists by any stretch. They think the inerrantists are full of shit.
Really?
And that Francis Schaeffer was a bit of an asshole, which he was. Francis Schaeffer was the architect of the Chicago Statement on Biblical Inerrancy.
If they ever listen to this show, they're going to start looking through the notes. Where did I say asshole at? I don't remember saying asshole.
Well, you know, it's the language of the people. What
oh,
can
okay.
I say?
All right.
But here's how they try to get around it, and here's why it doesn't work. Basically, they say that God providentially protects the central message of Christianity. That errors occur, and that's fine because the Spirit of God bears witness to what's true. And no matter how many changes occur in the Bible, the version that survives has, at the very least, it could be wrong on everything else, but it has the central core message of salvation in it.
Oh, my
gosh.
This
was Martin Luther's position, actually.
Oh, okay.
This is why Luther didn't have any problem encouraging higher criticism of the Bible or throwing out books that he thought were spurious, because he didn't have any commitment to the authority of Scripture. He thought that the Holy Spirit bore witness to the authority of Scripture, and that that inquiry would tell you what was legitimate and what wasn't. Calvin threw this out. Calvin recognized that this was a recipe for atheism.
Okay.
But people like Metzger and McGrath take Luther at his word, but they do. There's two schools that do this. There's the liberals and the neo-orthodox, people like Paul Tillich, Karl Barth, who take Luther at his word and go all the way with the biblical criticism and wind up holding on to only a very mystical notion of God. They hold on to a lot of the doctrines too, but they say God's bigger than that, and this is just the way that he's revealed to us. But conservative evangelicals like Metzger and McGrath say that, no, the central message is preserved in whatever survives. And therefore, we can trust the authority of Scripture, even if it's not authoritative all the time, right? There's culturally bound stuff, there's corruption, but the truth is still there.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with this position is that they don't allow that their interpretation of what's there is wrong.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, the first thing I thought, when you said the truth, I was like, okay, well, who's determining what the truth is?
Right. The position is completely circular, because what they're doing is they're taking orthodox doctrine, albeit kind of an anemic version of it, and they're saying that this is the central message borne out in Scripture. This is, but of course, this is what the canon was selected for.
Cart before the horse kind of thing.
You know, it wasn't selected by committee, but it kind of accreted by trade between people who believe mostly the same things. So they considered authoritative stuff that they already agreed with. So there's that problem, and then
right.
there's the further problem that Metzger and McGrath and people like that don't hold with alternate readings of the text. Say, for example, open theism or process theology or liberalism, all of which we were talking about earlier.
Right.
Because those aren't the central and essential message of Christianity, but they've got no basis on which to claim that they know what that is. So it falls apart, but it falls apart on a bit of a different level than what Drange is targeting here, which is the inerrantist camp.
Okay. Yes, still doesn't really work. Yeah, I've heard people say that all the time. And especially, earlier we talked about other religions, so you hear the same thing again from people, especially from Christians, they'll say, well, it's all the same God. It's all the same God. You know.
You can only say that if you haven't studied the other religions.
Exactly. Every time I hear that, I go, okay, yeah, this God says kill all infidels, this religion's God says love everybody. Which one is it? You know?
Oh, yeah, and speaking of Christians impeaching themselves, if you ever want to see a masterful illustration of why Christianity is in no way unique,
okay,
check out the appendix for Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis.
Oh, yeah?
Where he compares Hinduism, Taoism, and Buddhism with Christianity and lines up their parallel moral teachings.
Really?
Yeah, in order to prove that God is present in all of them.
Oh, wow. So he didn't really realize what he was doing was...
was proving that God was present in none of them.
Right.
Is if, you know, if something is everything, then it has no... It has no defining properties. So even if it does exist, it doesn't mean anything that it exists.
Mm-hmm. And actually, I guess in next, actually it's 10, but you already covered that, actually, I guess,
yeah.
In talking earlier about the argument from human insignificance. Thing. Right, right. Again, mm-hmm. Or the contact argument. No, just
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, Carl Sagan.
Yeah.
Beautiful on that point. It's an awful waste of space.
Yeah. Again, if you don't know where we are, ladies and gentlemen, maybe somebody can post for you. We got people in the stick cam room. We're going to be taking calls here in a second. Well, hopefully we'll get some callers. Don't know. We have 34 people listening to the stick cam, so that's
cool.
That's pretty positive. So that means people.
Good crowd today.
But it's also positive too because Silky Shrew is getting some listeners tonight, which is really positive.
Oh, fabulous!
Yeah, I wanted to make sure she got her listeners over there because she's talking about anal sex tonight. So by the way, some people in here right now are probably like, "Well, wait a minute." Where I need to switch over to the other feed. But anyway, I'm going to open the lines up now if you want to call in. 888-503-0802. Again, it's 888-503-0802. I feel like I messed that up somehow. But anyway, here we go. Let's take this first caller. Somebody's calling in here. Hello, you are live with the Infidel Guy and Dan Sawyer. Go ahead.
Hi, am I on?
You are on the air.
Okay, great. Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
I'm pretty good.
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 Hey, a couple of things. You know, I've spent quite a bit of time over the past couple of years trying to flesh out all these issues and try to understand people's position relative to a belief in God. And a lot of it, I think, is just common sense. I think a lot of times when you think about it, you know, people, for the most part, are not really strong in terms of, you know, being prepared to deal with things that maybe are going to require a change, and so therefore they get, you know, they just get rooted in their beliefs, and they don't ever want to be jarred from it. So the thing that really absolutely just put it home for me was when I got into reading all the apologetics. And at that point in time, I knew that, you know, this is a lost cause. I mean, these people will explain everything away. They always have an out because they can go to that supernatural
element. That's true.
Element and just simply pull something completely out of their ass. And it's just childish. You know, it's a childish game that they play. And when you're dealing with children, you're not going to get anywhere. It doesn't matter how much of this stuff that is put together and presented to them so that they can understand logic. The thing that really sent me over the top was, you know, Reg, I heard when you were had an interview with Dr. Dino.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, this guy is one of the young Earth creationists.
Right.
And the thing that just completely, you know, blows that out of the water is the speed of light. And the fact that if you take a look at, you know, the Earth only being a certain age, and yet you can establish that, you know, the universe in and of itself is well beyond maybe 13 to 15 billion years old, based upon computing the speed of light, then you go and you find the apologist answer to that. What they say that it's because God makes you see that light at a different speed, and it's just like
they call it tired light. And there's a very elaborate mathematical hypothesis behind it.
Tired light?
Tired light. I think Michael Shermer's written a couple of articles refuting it.
It's just ridiculous.
I mean, yeah, because I've heard Kent, or I might have read something, or heard him say something about referring to some studies about some experiment showing that the speed of light could actually be slowed down or something like that. And
oh, yeah, you shoot light through certain gases and it slows down, or you shoot it through cesium, for example, and it doubles. That's well established, but they can't get from here to there, so to speak, without inventing a lot of shit.
Right.
So ultimately what we're left with is trying to understand where we are. I mean, if we ultimately cannot, you know, take reason and you know, good sound science to try to help these people understand exactly what's what, because they've got some, you know, either emotional deficiencies or something else that they just simply have to have that belief in God, that's fine. The nice thing about it is that we as non-theists understand that, you know, it isn't within religion that morals becomes established. It's within society. And the fact that, you know, human beings are, in fact, social creatures, and that's where morals come from. So we both, what's nice is that we both agree that morals are a good thing. They think it comes from their God. We believe it comes from, you know, societal evolution.
Right.
That's great. So we got a common goal there that we both like morals. The problem is that it won't stop for them because they are required to go and proselytize. And that's the real scary thing about it is that ultimately they hold a very dangerous belief for everybody else. And as such, I really think that religion, all forms of religion, ought to be studied, ought to be required, you know, reading as a course for our
children. You're starting to sound like Dan Dennett.
I agree with you. The problem is, of course, finding, the problem, of course, is, who's going to teach it? And that's the problem.
well, exactly. Yeah, but, I mean, if they're being taught all of the religions so that these kids understand that, you know, hey, wow, look, I mean, look at all these commonalities in all these other religions other than my own.
Well, Stanley, sit down, okay? Everybody knows that Satan is the one who did that. He went back in time and tried to, he knew the Savior was coming, you know, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, there's a basic problem, though, that I think is common to all people. It's just exacerbated in religious people, of epistemic laziness.
Yes.
An argument that works okay for me here and now is one I'll employ, and later on, if I have to argue a different point, it's not in human nature to go back and look at the standard of truth you had in the last argument. You just grab what seems proper at the moment. And it's when you start to apply a consistent epistemology that religion falls apart. But until you do that, it can survive anything, no matter how ridiculous or how rational it is. Anyone's worldview can survive close scrutiny as long as they are not epistemically consistent. What was it? Michael Behe was forced to admit on the stand back in November that by his standards of scientific truth, astrology would have to be considered a legitimate science. It was obvious, reading the transcript, that he had never even thought in that direction before.
Right.
it's not that he's a liar, and it's not that he's dishonest. I mean, I think he's an opportunist, and I don't like his rhetorical style. I think it's intellectually dishonest. But it's obvious that he is in earnest about what he believes and what he's teaching. But he has not turned the light of critical thought back on, not to his own beliefs, but to his own argument process. And therefore, when the prosecuting counsel, or when the plaintiff's counsel hit him with that, he was so bowled over that he could do nothing but yimmer and yabber for a couple of seconds and then say, yeah, I guess it would have to be considered that way.
Well, it's just important that everybody understand that that it is a very dangerous scenario under which people are in it, put themselves in a position to where they can explain away everything, because then all it just simply means is that, you know, God forbid, and you know, to whatever degree you want to use that, you know, the religious right continue to make inroads in our political system, because they will be able to explain away the rationale for killing atheists or non-believers,
right,
or sending them to prison, or you know, whatever else they're going to want to do. It's just a very slippery slope for those people. And I just hope that, and I think that we will see, you know, everybody that has some reasonableness step in and see that these guys do not destroy what this country has been founded upon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to have hope that that will in fact happen.
Okay. Well, yeah. Thanks for the call. Let's stick to the logical arguments here. All right, thank you.
Yeah, along those lines, by the way, it's important that, you know, we recognize that problem in theists, but we very rarely turn it back around on ourselves.
Oh, yeah.
Sam Harris, in his blog on Huffington Post, has got three or four posts back a post called The Moral Necessity of Torture, where he talks about torture in time of war as equated with collateral damage, takes a hardline rationalist perspective, and completely destroys the natural liberal revulsion to torture as a conceivable means under some limited circumstances. Anybody listening who's a civil libertarian and a rationalist needs to go read this, because it turns that light that we shine on everybody else right back around onto our own convictions, and argues from a liberal humanist perspective that things are not always like we'd like them to be.
Oh, of course.
They're very, very good paper, and it'll keep you thinking for weeks.
All right, excellent. Let's take this next call here. Did you hang up on it? Did you hang up? No, he's there. Hello?
That was me. I was hearing
okay.
My phone.
All right, hello, you're on the air.
Yes. I was wondering, is there a position that goes along the lines of a natural God? And what does he think about it? You know, a being that's
E.T.?
That is material and eternal, but very limited in its capabilities. You know, basically, it can only do one thing and create the universe.
I call those advanced aliens myself, or an advanced alien. I mean, he could be the last of his race. I mean, there's all kind of fictional things I guess we can put in there. But
there's a couple of really serious ones, though. Straczynski's conception. Straczynski's an atheist, but for Babylon 5, he created this this god that's kind of all Carl Sagan's metaphors writ large.
Right.
That's actually a serious philosophical concept, that the universe is somehow all the parts interacting create God, the way that all the parts of our brains interacting create our minds.
Mm-hmm. We are the consciousness of the universe looking back at itself, trying to ask itself the question. You're right. Yeah. Right. Why does it exist? And trying. Yeah.
Yep.
I thought that was quite interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually a very serious philosophical concept. And the other one is the notion that there is something we could call God, and that's the recursive equation by which the universe perpetuates and exists. Say, for example, Stephen Hawking at the end of A Brief History of Time talking about the grand unified theory. When we find it, we'll know the mind of God. What he's looking for is a simple set of equations
exactly.
That you could perhaps write down on a page that put those in motion with no other parameters aside from a feedback loop into itself, and you get the universe, and that's God. Douglas Adams talked about this in his
in his book or in his speech, "Is There an Artificial God?" And there's a longer version of that essay reprinted in The Salmon of Doubt. It's really worth reading.
All right, again, ladies and gentlemen, that number to call in to is 888-503-0802. If you have any questions or comments, like somebody just called and hung up there. Again, the number is 888-50. In fact, let me type this in the chat room here. 503-0802. If you have any... Some of you, oops, I skipped the zero there, but you guys know what I'm trying to say there. Some of you might have, button stuck on me here. Some of you might have some logical arguments yourself. You might want to call in, or you might be a theist. We have some issues with some of the arguments, and you want to talk to us about why you think there is a God, despite these arguments. Some would argue that they're proofs. So please give us a call here.
Yeah.
We don't worry.
On the Rotten Tomatoes.
And we won't bite you either, so, which is pretty cool. And we're waiting.
Done the silence. Is there anything in the chat room?
No, but it's funny. There is one thing here that Ted did write on the page here, on his article here. He says, all theistic arguments for God's existence can be refuted by at least one objection. And all of the definitions of God considered here permit God's non-existence to be established, or else God talk to be shown incoherent by at least one argument.
I think he's probably about right on that.
His other definitions of God are used in ordinary language, but all of them permit God's non-existence to be established by appeal to similar or analogous considerations.
Yep.
There is much more to be said about the various arguments. So, yeah, you guys, there's a lot more out there. I mean, these are just 10 of which Ted thought were pretty good and was covered some general areas, but there's a heck of a lot more arguments out there.
Yeah, and we actually addressed quite a few more than just the 10 that Ted put up there, because as we were going through and trying to expand them to cover more than just evangelical Christianity.
That's true. We got another call that just called in here, too. Let's take this one. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, can we agree that that we ultimately don't know whether or not there is or isn't a God?
Depends on the definition.
I'm okay with that.
Don't we get to a point after you go through a couple of iterations where we ultimately get that, I don't on my side have definitive proof to say that there is not a God, and on their side, unless you're dealing with, you know, some of the wackos that just simply think that they do, that you find some theists that will say, hey, you're right, I don't have any absolute proof. And in fact, that is the most critical part of faith, because it's what they talk about making a leap of faith. I don't have proof that God exists, but I'm going to believe it and leap to that conclusion. Now, here's what's fascinating is that, okay, great. That's a key component of the overall meaning of faith.
I don't know. I'm sorry. I mean, very quickly, they say it.
No, keep going. I'm with you on this.
Yeah, because here's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
When if that is in fact part of the, you know, or in fact even the crux of the meaning of faith, when you do encounter a group of theists that say, you know what, I have the answer, I know the truth.
Right.
Then those people are no longer making a leap of faith. They
don't have any
chasm to jump over.
Yeah,
they know the truth. So they are no longer people of faith.
I've argued that for years. Right.
Okay. Are we not in agreement on that?
Yeah, no, I'm okay with you up to this point. Now, the problem comes in with you make the leap of faith. Now, what does it look like on the other side of that chasm? Because if you are living by faith by the dictates of a God, you run into the problem of when God orders things that are against your conscience. Letters and Papers from Prison, Dietrich Bonhoeffer dealt with this extensively and came to the conclusion that in order to properly honor God, if he was to be a good Christian, he had to behave as if God didn't exist. And in my own journey, I came to a similar conclusion. Before my deconversion, I wound up as a Jesus radical for quite a while. And it occurred to me that whether there is a God or not, life is a gift. and behaving as if it's a gift rather than a burden is the only possible way you can honor a God. And if there's not a God, it's the best possible way to enjoy your life. But the minute you start living by the dictates of a set of scriptures
mm-hmm.
that go either contrary to your own conscience or they have to be twisted in order to fit it, you've gone past faith and into something that's not either intellectually or morally justifiable, even by the standards of Christianity.
I agree. You guys doing a great job. Keep up the good work.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah, what I was trying to argue earlier when I tried to interject there was that I wanted to follow up on when he said basically they have faith. And, of course, as you know, there are so many people out there who say, though, well, I just have faith in my Lord, but they really mean something a little even more deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you were to ask that same person, well, do you know 90% of all those people who say they have faith in God, well, I should say 90% of the evangelicals will tell the, if they say they have faith, they will tell you they also know it. So
mm-hmm.
I don't think they understand the distinction, actually.
Yeah, it's a major category confusion. It's,
right.
You know, you've seen a movie or watched a TV show or read a book where the characters were so well drawn that they became real to you. And when the story was over...
Like Bambi. That's why you cry on Bambi, you know, things like
right.
that.
Right. Some part of you grieves when they die. Some part of you misses them when you're not reading the story anymore. Now, that's a kind of faith, and it's a very analogous faith to religious faith. Now, for example, I'm a big B5 junkie, which is why I quote Straczynski a lot.
Me too, by the way.
Cool.
Yeah, my family, Amber and I, we're going to watch some B5 in a minute here.
Oh, yeah, well, I won't spoil anything for you then, but, oh, yeah, it gets better. From wherever you are, it gets better. but if I was to discover that, for example, Captain Sheridan
mm-hmm.
or Marcus were real people,
right.
I would be elated, overjoyed, and I'd probably send them a thank you note. You have enriched my life. Thank you so much. I didn't know you were real, but you enriched my life anyway.
Right.
You know, but that's the difference between believing and knowing. Just having the faith in the story, they can enrich my life, I can enjoy it, it can affect my thought processes, and hey, it has. But if I were to actually bump into them on the street, and
mm-hmm.
they were, say, gods instead of people, I tell you, right away, my life would completely change. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would be at their beck and call, and I would have to trust them if they were God.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to trust them to say, to tell me only what's right. But Christians who say they know rather than they just believe,
right?
They're lying. I mean, they don't under. I mean, it's not a self-conscious.
I know what you mean.
Prevarication, but they
right.
don't understand the difference because they do not live
as if they
as
really did know it, right?
As if they knew it, and a lot of the Christians through history that on the good side that did live as if they knew it
mm-hmm.
came to the conclusion that the only way to do that was to live as if it wasn't true. Because they look back on the bloody
That's
history
right.
of the religion, and they saw what happened when everyone took every word literally, or took what
mm-hmm.
they liked literally.
Right.
And they came to the conclusion that if it's really true, and I know it is, I can't get around it, I've tried every way to argue myself out of it, it is really true, so I have to act in a way that will honor God, not a way that will honor a book. I can't make the book an idol, I can't make
mm-hmm.
myself an idol.
Hmm, interesting.
That's, you know, if someone really believes they know that this is the case,
right?
I think you get either Martin Luther King, well, his good points, or Dietrich Bonhoeffer, or on the other side, you get Hitler. There's not a lot
right.
of middle ground.
Exactly. I've argued that before. You probably heard a show in which I was talking about. Remember that there was a guy who was on trial in the Atlanta courtroom, and he shot a few...
Right.
And I remember thinking, now, he's a believer in God, apparently. And I remember thinking, if we really think we know that there really is this God and that there's a demonic world that exists, why don't we excuse these people if they're really possessed by demons? Why don't we just say a few prayers, put them in some church for a little while, and
say...
They should be exercised, not executed.
Exactly, right.
So because they can't be culpable for what the demon did through them.
Exactly. So it makes you wonder, what do we really believe? Is that right? We live our lives as if really there is no God. And
yeah.
I remember reading somewhere also, similar to this, is about testing whether or not we are truly moral beings or not is when we do the right thing, even though no one is watching. And it goes right back to what you're saying about this God idea, which is pretty much what you're talking about, is that, a true Christian, if they really want to please God, why don't you pretend that he's simply not there and then but still do the right thing? And I'm sorry, but in my life, I see the complete opposite of this. I see people sinning purposefully and because they know they can go to church Sunday and repent.
And be absolved, yeah.
Right.
And I tell you, if there is a God, what better way to spit in his face and shit on his table than by acting that way?
Gosh. Okay, well, God knows my heart. That would be the response.
Yeah, well, your heart is born out through your actions, dude, and it's pretty obvious what it is.
Well, you know, hey, I had a great time, Dan, talking to you about the logical arguments and then ranting about other things as well.
Oh, absolutely. I had a great time, too. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to get you back on the program to talk to you about, again, your path of free thought and more about what you learned while you're involved in all these, your education, your theological education, as to say. And didn't you tell me, you said at one point, you said when you were just in your teens, and you said you read hundreds of books on a...
No, that was, I've been a bookworm ever since.
Okay.
Ever since I could read, but no, it was in the... I've read several thousand books over the course of my life, but my path to free thought began quite unbeknownst to myself when I read Time Enough for Love by Robert Heinlein when I was 15 years old.
Wow. That's right. You graduated from high school when you were 15, didn't you?
Yeah.
Crazy. A functioning genius, I guess, huh?
Well, just enough to get myself in trouble.
We can find out more about... Do you have any bios or any of this that we can find out more about you, too, by the way? I'm just curious.
I maintain two websites. One is a community site for independent filmmakers and graphic artists. That's www.blenderwars.com.
Blender Wars, okay.
Yeah, I post there as Lochmer. And then there's my professional site, www.artisticwhispers.com. And that'll show you some of the projects I've been involved in and some of the stuff I do professionally.
All right, excellent. Hey, thanks a lot for helping me out tonight. And
problem.
We'll have you back in the future.
All right. Hey, enjoy B5. Just out of curiosity, where are you in the show?
Fourth season. Yeah.
Oh, you are in for a treat.
All right, man.
All right, have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, well, you heard it right here. Too bad we didn't get any theistic callers. I really would appreciate that, having some theistic callers call in, because I really want to hear what their arguments are for the existence of their gods. I think it's very important that I learn what other people are thinking about when it comes to their deities, because, I mean, I can learn something. There's a lot I know that I don't know, and Dan obviously has a heck of a lot more knowledge about this stuff than I do. So, this goes to show that no matter how old you get, no matter how much you learn, there's still always so much more to learn. And I'll tell you what, and that's one thing that helps keeping me want to be here on this earth is experiencing life. And that's all the process of learning. And learning... being with my family is just a wonderful thing. And that's one reason why I continue to want to be here. And, I guess that's it. It's just, I guess I'm kind of talking to some of the new listeners who might be checking us out through StickCam. It's just that many people think that atheists are depressed all the time and down and angry. We hate God. We hate religion. And that's just not the case. Most atheists I know understand that this is the only life that we have unless we can, I don't know, they can... reproduce our neurons in some way, or clone us or something. I don't know. Even then, that'd be impossible. But anyway, not the neuron thing, but the cloning doesn't work that way. But anyway, I forgot where I was going with that. Oh, yeah, so we try to live life to the fullest, most non-believers I know. And most of us would actually protect your right to believe what you want to believe. It's just that when you start trying to tell us that we need to believe what you believe in order to be moral people, we have issues with you. I'll see you another time. Join us again at InfidelGuy.com. It's radio that rocks your rational mind in reason.